This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research. Environmental scientist and ecologist Jane Lubchenco's interests range from searching for specimens in the Oregon coastline's tide pools to promoting the public's understanding of science. Her research interests include plant-herbivore interactions, biogeography, and global change. She is currently the Undersecretary of Commerce and Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She is the first woman and the first marine ecologist to lead NOAA. She was interviewed by Dorian Devins in 2004.
You were born in Colorado.
Yes, I grew up in Denver. It was a great place to grow up.
Were there scientists in your family?
Both my mom and dad were physicians. Mom was a pediatrician, daddy was a surgeon, and they both had strong, keen interests in science, but a lot of other interests as well. I had five younger sisters, and they encouraged all of us to explore lots of different kinds of worlds. Unlike a lot of physicians, they didn't expect that their children would also grow up to be doctors. They really wanted us to explore and figure out what it was that we liked and then pursue that.
Kind of ironic, you grew up in Colorado and you got into marine ecology because that's about as inland as you can get.
It is. We spent a lot of time in the outdoors. We were very active. We did a lot of camping, a lot of hiking, and I grew up really liking being outside, learning to be very observant of the natural world through Girl Scouts and through family activities. When I was in college, between my junior and senior years, I had the opportunity to go to Woods Hole for the summer and take a class at the Marine Biological Laboratories in invertebrate zoology. And I discovered just this most amazing world. It was exotic, it was diverse, it was intriguing. So I really fell in love with the living critters in the oceans that summer between my junior and senior years in college. I think Woods Hole has been a catalytic experience for a lot of people. And certainly for me, it was both the opportunity to discover a whole new world, but I also was invited to stay and do an independent research project after the course was over. So it was my first real taste of what research was all about. And most of the other students in the class were graduate students. There were just two of us that were undergrads. So I learned a lot from listening to them about what graduate school was all about. And I thought, this is what I want. I just love doing research. I love marine ecology, marine biology. I want more.
And there must have been some great scientists working there that you came in contact with to inspire you further.
There were six instructors in the class, each of whom had his own specialty, and they were all very different, but also very passionate about what it was that they did. And of course, there are hundreds of other scientists at MBL and HUI, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, that are all doing their own science. So there were lectures each week. And then all the other graduate students that were doing their research were talking about what they were doing. It's just very intellectually active, exciting, vigorous, stimulating place.
Going from there back to Colorado, did you look at your surroundings there through different eyes, having dealt with a whole different ecosystem?
I think that I was just more aware that there were lots of other worlds out there that I hadn't been exposed to, even though I had had a rich array of experiences growing up. We did a lot of traveling. But I realized that I really wanted to go to graduate school and really, you know, had gotten this taste of doing research, so I wanted more of that. So that summer convinced me that I really, then I knew what I wanted to do after college.
What kind of research were you doing at Woods Hole exactly?
It was a focus on an individual clam, Yoldia, and there was a structure on the edge of the clam whose function was unknown. And I did a bunch of behavioral experiments and histology to try to get an understanding of what purpose it might serve. And it was the kind of project that discovered some interesting things, not enough to really be publishable, but enough to give me a sense of what the discovery process, what the research process was all about, and the extent to which they're often dead ends or things that don't work or things that in hindsight you should have designed differently. It was more just an extremely valuable experience for me about the research process.
So from there, did you decide you wanted to take on as a research subject?
No, I think that summer just gave me direction relative to marine systems and relative to graduate school. I started graduate school at the University of Washington, and that was a very different and very transformative experience. I had been exposed to ecology earlier, but never experimental ecology and never evolutionary ecology. And there was a just superb group of faculty at the University of Washington in the zoology department that did evolutionary and experimental ecology, both in terrestrial systems as well as in marine systems. So I was exposed there to a different framework for thinking about how to address ecological patterns. Friday Harbor in the San Juan Islands is the place where the marine station is for the University of Washington. And I had opportunity to do research up there. So what I ended up doing for my research was quite different from anything I had been exposed to at Woods Hole. But, you know, one thing leads to another, leads to another.
How long did you stay at Washington?
I was initially in a PhD program at the University of Washington, but during my first year, I met Bruce Menge, who was the person I eventually married. He was a sixth-year graduate student, so he was in the process of finishing his degree. And he had a postdoc at University of California at Santa Barbara. So I took a leave of absence my second year and went down to Santa Barbara to be with him, and ended up doing a totally different research project down there on Santa Cruz Island, one of the Channel Islands. So I just did independent research for a year. We went back up to Seattle in the end of that year, and I finished the project that I had initiated when I was there and wrote it up as my master's degree. And by that time, Bruce had accepted a job at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. So we moved out to the East Coast, and I started graduate school at Harvard University. So I was doing marine ecology there as well. Much of what I did for my PhD dissertation was very strongly influenced by the folks that I had been strongly impressed by at the University of Washington. So even though I was there for a very short period of time, the philosophy and the attitudes and the intellectual framework of those people really has had a lasting influence on the way I think about problems.
Were there particular people at Washington, University of Washington?
Yeah, absolutely. Bob Payne was my advisor, and he has very wonderful, strong ideas about using experiments to really test ideas. Much of ecology had historically been finding correlations between different kinds of things. Critters high on the shore, for example, are more tolerant of desiccation. Critters lower on the shore, less so. And so there's a correlation between tolerance and position on shore. And many people had assumed that those correlations were causal. And experiments are a very powerful way to distinguish correlation from causation. In some cases, they are in the same direction. Other times, there's something else going on. But the ability on rocky seashores to actually transplant things from high on the shore to low on the shore, or vice versa, or to cage out predators or herbivores or remove them from a system, allow the actual testing of a lot of ideas that people had just assumed were explanations for various patterns. And Bob Payne and Joe Connell, who was the person my husband did his postdoc with at Santa Barbara, were two pioneers in experimental marine ecology. And that philosophy has been one that I adopted and that is very much part and parcel of the way that I have continued to do my research. So Bob Payne, certainly. Alan Cohn and Gordon Oriens were two other faculty members at the University of Washington who, you know, the three of them had very strong ideas about science. They didn't always agree, but each of them had something uniquely important to offer, and I benefited tremendously from being exposed to them and to their group of students that were there.
So for that example you gave of the positioning, was it causal, or what was the outcome?
The outcome is that the general pattern that has emerged around the world from people doing those kinds of experiments is that zonation patterns that one sees on the seashore are a function of the interplay between physical and biological factors. The upper limits of most species do tend to be set by physical factors. So things don't go higher on the shore because they dry out. But on the other hand, and this was the new contribution of the experimental approach, their lower limits tend to be set by biological factors. There are predators down lower, or there are competitors that are superior at occupying space. And so one of the major contributions of Joe Connell and Bob Payne was identification of some of those biological factors, competition, predation, that were setting lower limits, but also the interplay between the physical and the biological. Prior to those experiments, the assumption was that it was all physical, that critters on the shore lived where they were best able to function. And turns out that's not true. Most things actually grow faster and do better lower on the shore because they're underwater for longer, it's less stressful, there's more food. But many of them can't make it lower on the shore because they get eaten or because there's a superior competitor down there.
Did you do work on this also?
I did. Part of what I worked on for my PhD dissertation was looking at zonation patterns in seaweeds, and that's exactly what I found. I did transplants, I did removals of herbivores, I looked at competitive interactions between the seaweeds. These were on the rocky shores along the New England coast, so Massachusetts and Maine, and did definitive studies that showed that in fact the zonation patterns of seaweeds were this combination of upper limits being set by physical factors and lower limits being set by, in this case, competition between seaweeds.
I guess in a way you could look at the upper limit and the physical factor is that I guess these plants or animals are kind of striving in a way. They're hitting their upper limit by doing that. I mean, they go as far as the physical situation will allow them to.
Since those early experiments were done on rocky shore systems, that same interplay of biological and physical factors has been applied to zonation patterns going up mountainsides, for example, or any of the other zonation patterns that you tend to see in any system. And by and large, the same phenomena tend to be the case. So I've been really fortunate to be able to work in a system where you really can do rigorous testing of hypotheses. And the body of information that has come out of rocky intertidal communities has been pretty phenomenal and has influenced the way people think about interactions in general and what it is that causes ecological patterns in nature.
At this point, were you interested at all in the human interaction in this system? Or
when I was doing my research, both during my graduate years and as a young assistant professor, I wasn't really thinking much about human influence on ecological systems, in part because it wasn't that obvious. And during the time that I was working in different coastal marine ecosystems, eventually many places around the world, and going back to the same places over and over and over, I began to see very dramatic, very real changes in the systems that I knew well And it was pretty obvious that some of those changes were due to a number of different kinds of human activities. So I personally saw systems being degraded in a short amount of time, and became much more concerned about the pace of change and the extent to which not many people knew about those changes. You know, if you go to a system and you don't have any history in it, it's hard to see that it might be different from the way that it should be. One of the most dramatic examples for me of observing the change firsthand came in the Caribbean, Jamaica. When I was a young assistant professor at Harvard University, I had the privilege of teaching part of a coral reef ecology course on the north side of Jamaica. There was a marine station there, Discovery Bay Marine Laboratory, that was just the most amazing place and had a long, distinguished tradition of really good ecologists and invertebrate biologists studying these amazing coral reefs. We did a lot of diving on these very old and very diverse, just lush, spectacularly beautiful coral reefs. The visibility there is amazing. Some, you know, up to 200 feet you can see. So you can even just be floating on the surface and look down over these amazing reefs all the way, you know, it drops off 500-600 feet, just keeps going down and down, and so you can just see forever. So I knew that place. Students that were in the course and I did transects. We took a lot of data. We were doing pilot short experiments on the system. And then I didn't have a chance to go back to Discovery Bay for a number of years until we had a scientific meeting there that would have been actually maybe, I don't know how many years later it was, certainly more than 10. And that reef system has gone from being just this spectacular, lush, beautiful, diverse place to one that's now totally trashed. It's been overgrown by weedy seaweeds. Most of the corals are dead. And because of a lot of work that had been done there, much of which was done by colleagues of mine, we actually know why it has changed. And it's a combination of overfishing, of logging on the land and transport of sediment onto the coral reefs, which smothers them. The release of raw sewage into the water, and so that excess nitrogen stimulates the growth of the weedy seaweeds, and they can overgrow and outcompete the corals, especially if there aren't any herbivores there to be keeping the seaweeds under control. So the whole system is out of balance due to a number of different problems. Climate change probably has exacerbated that because the water is warmer. And so in a relatively short period of time, this coral reef went from being just the most beautiful place I had ever seen to a wasteland. And I remember very vividly not really expecting that, and getting in the water and seeing the changes. I think I had known that there had been changes, but actually seeing it was a very powerful, very emotional experience, because it's just so sad.
I was going to ask you a question, but then I realized my way of thinking was completely wrong. I was going to say, how do you tell whether something is amiss with, you know, things being dumped into the water and causing these things, or whether it's just natural evolution? But of course, all evolution is sparked by something, whether it be sewage being dumped in or some other change in the balance. So natural or not, this is an evolutionary process that's going on, though caused by man.
So what is, I mean, ecological systems have always changed. They've always gone through fluctuations or had new things introduced into the system. So change is nothing that's new. And over evolutionary time, much of that change has provided opportunities for species to succeed or others not to. What's so different now about any time in the past are the rates of change and the breadth of the area over which changes are happening. And human activities have also introduced some new kinds of changes that were never there before. Chemicals that we have invented and released that are absolutely brand new. So the rates of change, the spatial scale of change, and the kinds of changes are just overwhelming a lot of natural systems. And in many cases, changing them in dramatic ways. And that's one of the reasons that we are seeing so many different ecosystems around the world being disrupted and not able to provide the full range of goods and services that people have come to expect from ecological systems, even though we're not really aware of many of the services that are provided.
I guess there have been many extinctions and mutations also come out of this for the animals and the plants.
There are quite a few global scale changes that scientists have actually documented well. And relative to extinctions, we know, for example, that the rate at which species are going extinct is on the order of between 100 and 1,000 times greater than what would be the case without all these human activities. So we've vastly accelerated the rates of extinction. We also know that we have modified a lot of the basic cycles of the planet, for example, the nitrogen cycle. There's plenty of nitrogen in the air around us, but it's not in a form that most plants can use. They need nitrogen for growth. The process of converting nitrogen that's in the air to a usable form is called nitrogen fixation. And nitrogen fixation happens naturally by the action of bacteria or algae. And some of my colleagues, Peter Vertusik and others, have done calculations about what the natural rates of nitrogen fixation are around the world, you know, at the global scale. So we can actually calculate what the natural rates are and then the extent to which humans have modified the rate of nitrogen fixation. And what they've discovered is that by the making of fertilizer primarily, but also burning of fossil fuels, which also creates some fixed nitrogen, humans have now more than doubled the amount of nitrogen that is coming into the nitrogen cycle every year. And so that's a massive global scale alteration of one of the very basic biogeochemical cycles of the planet.
I would guess there must be some effect on human health.
There absolutely is an effect on human health. Too much nitrogen in drinking water is not good. Excess amounts of fixed nitrogen also are triggering harmful algal blooms, red tides, and other explosions of some kinds of microscopic plants in coastal waters around the world. Some of those harmful algal blooms produce toxins that, in fact, are problematic for people. They contaminate shellfish or cause fish kills. The excess nitrogen in other coastal waters is causing zones of low oxygen, hypoxic zones, which are commonly called dead zones. And so, for example, all of the nitrogen that is being applied to corn and soybeans and other crops in the whole central portion of the U.S., not all of the nitrogen from the fertilizers actually goes into growing those crops. A lot of it is washed off during storms into rivers and streams and is transported down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. And so there is too much nitrogen that's coming down the river, and this nitrogen pollution stimulates the growth of small plants in the water. They grow just explosively, begin to decay, and the bacteria that are decomposing them then use up all the oxygen in the water. And so that zone of low oxygen, the so-called dead zone, is now a huge area in the Gulf of Mexico where very few living things can survive. It really is a dead zone. And the dead zone is increasing in size. It's now about the size of the state of Massachusetts. And it's persisting, it's growing, and is a direct result of this nitrogen pollution, if you will. There are now some 30 to 40 dead zones around the world, all of which have appeared in the last couple of decades, and they're all at the mouths of rivers that drain major agricultural areas. So this again is part of the nitrogen story, that human activities have inadvertently modified one of the major biogeochemical cycles of the planet, and we're seeing consequences to ecological systems as well as to human health and to economic systems. The shrimp fishermen in the Gulf of Mexico, there are no shrimp in this dead zone. You know, there are no fish to catch in this dead zone.
I assume these would keep growing if this continues unabated then? These dead zones would get bigger, or there'd be more of them?
That's exactly what's happening. They are growing in size as more and more nitrogen is accumulated. So there's a huge opportunity here to use the scientific information about what it is that's causing these changes and figure out how to use fertilizers so that they are just growing the crops for which they are intended, not having all of these unfortunate and unintended other consequences. And that's, I think, one of the real challenges, both for that example as well as others, is to use the information that we have and figure out how to do things differently, how to transition to a more sustainable set of practices and policies where we're not having the unintended consequences, but we can still have some of the benefits.
I suppose this would depend to some degree on where these dead zones are. In the more developed countries, it might be easier for them to have alternatives to what they're doing now, as opposed to a poorer country where they might not have the resources to do something more sophisticated.
Yep, that's absolutely the case. It's going to play out differently different parts of the world.
The more developed countries or the wealthy countries have a responsibility to take the problem in hand.
I think the developed world has a responsibility not only to fix its own problems, but to be better global citizens in having less of an impact that it is undesirable, but also assisting all nations because, you know, we're all in this together. It's in everybody's interests to have the problems be fixed. And so working more collaboratively toward that is a good goal, if a very difficult one.
The environment has so many effects, and we mentioned human health and the economy, even national security.
Yeah, I think that one thing that we're learning from the scientific information around the world with respect to how the planet is changing is the extent to which we haven't really appreciated how important the ecological systems of the planet are to the kinds of things that people care about. And I think that we're in the process of redefining what the environment means. And I would suggest that we are beginning to appreciate the extent to which the environment has very strong connections to human health, to the economy, to social justice, and to national security. So those are very different kinds of things, but we're beginning to understand these connections and to see the extent to which putting a greater priority on protecting and restoring the ecological systems that provide the life support systems for everybody on the planet, in fact, is going to help our economy, is going to help national security, is going to help human health and other things. Let me give you an example of the national security issue, because it's one that I think is surprising to many people. Many countries that have experienced a very significant amount of civil strife are having difficulties in part because their local ecosystems are so highly degraded. So environmental degradation often can trigger civil war and civil strife. And when that happens, you then get a huge number of refugees that are leaving a particular country and seeking a better kind of life and are coming from a world in which the distinction between the rich and the poor is so extreme that there's often just huge inequities. And so refugees crossing borders are very much a national security issue. Another example might be, even within developed countries, there is often intense competition for resources, water, for example, or fish. And in the U.S., we've had salmon wars on the West Coast with Canada, on the East Coast, cod wars between the U.S. and Canada. And so those are marine resources over which countries are fighting, and over which there have been, in the past, some very serious strife. And so resources that might be desired by both countries can, in fact, trigger strife between nations.
You had mentioned earlier goods and services provided by these ecosystems. Is that what you mean by goods and services?
Yes. Most ecosystems provide a wide range of goods and services that people have not really paid much attention to in the past. Ecosystem services are benefits that are provided to people simply by virtue of the functioning of that ecosystem. So the plants and animals and microbes that are in an ecological system, just by virtue of their doing what they do, interacting, growing, reproducing, whatever, that system provides a wide range of services, many of which are critically important to people, even though we haven't paid attention to them. So different kinds of systems, whether it is a grassland or a forest or a coral reef or a kelp forest, each of those different types of ecosystems provides some kind of goods and services. The goods are things that we've paid lots of attention to because we fish for fish or we cut down trees for timber. And so those are examples of the goods. The services are less tangible and include things like the purification of water, purification of air, partial climate regulation, the provision of pollinators, flood control, decomposition. Those are all ecosystem services that are a byproduct of the functioning of the critters within an ecosystem. And we haven't paid much attention to those services. We don't buy and sell and trade them like we do the goods. We don't have mechanisms for knowing when they are becoming rare, and we don't have ways of incorporating their importance into the kinds of decision-making that happens. So if a country or a city is interested in cutting down its timber or filling in a wetland to build an airport, there's obvious economic benefit, but there's no part of the equation that accounts for the loss of the services that that forest or that wetland might have provided. This is an area that is very exciting scientifically and also very relevant socially, to try to figure out how to make decisions where we're doing a more complete accounting of the trade-offs, that does a better job of thinking about the ecosystem services and how important it is for us to continue to have them. So the goods and services together really provide the life support systems for the entire planet. And as we are losing species, as we're modifying the nitrogen cycle, as we're fragmenting habitat, as we are transforming the land or changing the climate, part of what we are doing is disrupting the ecological systems that provide those goods and services. And that challenge of figuring out how to be able to utilize these systems without totally disrupting them is a huge challenge. And in fact, I think the major challenge for all societies today is to figure out how to make a transition to sustainability, which means being able to provide even the most basic needs for all people, while at the same time protecting and restoring the ecosystems that provide these goods and services. Currently, we are trying to provide for basic needs, but we're doing so by disrupting the ecosystems that are providing the goods and services. And so making a transition to sustainability really means figuring out how to provide those basic needs while also protecting and restoring the ecosystems that provide the goods and services.
It's almost as if it's an equation that is incomplete. You haven't assigned values, either literally or figuratively, to these goods and services, and maybe in some way you have to determine a value for them so you can figure where the outcome is and how you want things to be in the end.
Mm-hmm. It's a huge challenge, and it's a challenge for scientists as well as a challenge for society. Scientific information is going to be critically important in helping us understand what might be done, what the range of options are, what the likely consequences of different choices are, and for that information to be available to society in a way that is understandable and accessible is critically important. Just having that information doesn't necessarily mean people will act on it, but if it isn't there, then there's a lost opportunity to be able to, when the time comes that there is a desire to do something, that scientific information isn't there, then that's a real lost opportunity.
This may be asking you to step outside of your field and to be a psychologist for a moment, but why do you think it is that people, that humans don't value the ecosystems? I mean, is it because they're part of them in a sense and it's hard to be within something and assign value to it, or is there something else?
I think there are probably multiple reasons, but I think one of them is that humans have long lived in a world where resources were not limiting. There was always plenty of clean air, plenty of fish in the ocean, plenty of fresh water, not every place, but a lot of places. And in a very, very rapid period of time, that's changed. And it's partly a function of the fact that the human population has grown at such an explosive rate, so there's so many more people. And it's a consequence of the way that we use resources in a very, very wasteful fashion, because we've never really had to pay attention to the wastes or think about running out of the raw materials. So we've been asleep at the switch, and a lot of people still are not cognizant of the very, very rapid changes that are underway.
Can you give an example of these rapid changes that are underway due to human wastefulness?
I think perhaps oceans is a prime example of that. I had the pleasure of serving this last year on the Pew Oceans Commission, which was an independent group of national leaders, 18 of us, who were charged with making recommendations to the country about ocean policies and practices. And it was the first time in over 30 years that the country has had a commission to look at oceans. The commission that existed a little over 30 years ago now was called the Stratton Commission. Its report was released in 1969. And at the time of the Stratton Commission report, we truly believed, most people truly believed, that oceans were infinitely bountiful and infinitely resilient. The oceans are so vast, they're so productive, that it was inconceivable to most people that we could actually overfish them. And so most of the recommendations of the Stratton Commission were focused on understanding that oceans were a vast frontier with amazing resources, and the real challenge to the country was to build up its fishing capacity, build up its technology to be able to access and develop ocean resources, whether it was mining or drilling for gas or oil or fishing. And that was, you know, only some 30 years ago. Fast forward to the future, and we are seeing very serious depletion of fisheries around the world, and even within our own exclusive economic zone. Off the west coast of Oregon, where I live, there is the largest fishery closure ever. Some 8,000 square miles are closed to ground fishing because a number of species of rockfish have been so depleted that they just had to close the fishery. There was no other answer. So in a very short period of time, we've gone from bounty to serious collapse. And I think that sort of being caught up short is true of a lot of environmental issues right now. Mm-hmm. We just didn't anticipate how rapidly things could change or the extent to which we could make serious inroads, and we've done so inadvertently on lots of different fronts. So the challenges, I think, are partly having enough people be aware of the problem, but even more importantly, understanding that solutions are possible and that it is quite feasible to do things in a more efficient way, to do things differently, and to do things where there is much better balance. So I think there is both urgency and hope in addressing this wide range of environmental problems, both on land as well as in the oceans.
I guess people are accustomed to being aware of goods and services becoming depleted, either by scarcity, not being able to find them, or the cost going up. It seems to be the way people recognize there's a problem when things suddenly cost a lot more.
That's exactly right. And we do use that economic information to signal when something is rare. And if we don't have that information, it's harder to know what to do. And we haven't tracked services. We don't assign monetary value to them. We don't buy and sell and trade them. And so we don't have the same kind of information about how abundant they are or how scarce they are to help feed into the whole process.
Has the report on the Pew study come out yet?
Yes, the Pew Oceans Commission report was released last June. It is an absolutely amazing report in relying on really good science, but incorporating that into a blueprint for how the nation might do a better job of managing activities that affect oceans. We discovered that the area that's within the U.S. exclusive economic zone, so 200 nautical miles out away from the shore all around, that whole area is the equivalent of 1.5 times the continental U.S., 48 states. So it's a huge amount of territory. And as such, it is the country's largest public domain. The Pew Commission suggests that it should be managed as a public trust, managed for the common good and in perpetuity, and we don't do that right now. It's very much a free-for-all. It's not managed for all citizens. There are specific special interests who use oceans, and that's what has determined how it be used. So that the concept of a public trust is simply that it should be managed for everyone's benefit, not just a few special interests. And it should be managed for the long term, and that's not what we've been doing. It's been very much focused on short-term use as opposed to longer-term benefit.
Is this part of this new social contract that you wrote up?
The social contract is a concept that I proposed when I was president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And I believe that scientists have a social contract with society, that in return for society supporting what scientists do, I believe that scientists have an obligation to focus their energies and their time on the most urgent needs that society has, and to not only discover new information, but to share it more widely. And so the social contract with society is very much one of scientists being responsible and responsive to the needs of society. That, to me, means thinking about the big major challenges that are out there, which right now I think is making this transition to sustainability, and focusing our energies on providing the new knowledge, the new discoveries that are going to enable society to make this transition, and then making that information more understandable, more accessible, than simply publishing it in the peer-reviewed literature and then stopping at that point. So that doesn't mean doing super, super applied work. It also means making very fundamental discoveries across all areas of science. So this is not just environmental science. It's actually the full spectrum of science, technology, engineering, and doing so in innovative, interdisciplinary, collaborative ways that really pushed the intellectual frontiers of our knowledge, but also are being helpful to society. You know, if we can't make that transition to sustainability, all this other stuff is for naught. So I see that as the big looming challenge and believe that scientists have a responsibility to be helpful in being part of the solution.
Many of these very important areas, these very important issues that would be covered by this, let's say sustainability as a good example, even if you have every scientist in the world doing that, doing their part to get it to the public, it still has to be addressed on the policy level, which is a whole nother ball of wax. You still need to be able to deal with the political powers that be, and then, of course, on an international level. And you also take part in some of this.
I do. Most of the way scientists are trained is geared to doing research and publishing it for other scientists. And as I mentioned, I think that that's only the first step, and it's critically important to do that discovery and to publish in scientific literature. But I think that it's critically important for scientists to also share that new knowledge with a variety of people who are interested in it or who need that information. Those other audiences are the public, but also policymakers, corporate leaders, media, a wide array of non-governmental organizations that are actively using information, trying to find solutions. And I think that it is unfortunate that most scientists don't have the foggiest idea how to do that translation, how to speak in understandable language and describe often very complicated findings, very esoteric things, in ways that are accessible and interesting. We started a couple of years ago through the Ecological Society of America a new training program for environmental scientists to do just that. It's called the Aldo Leopold Leadership Program. We take 20 environmental scientists that are mid-career academics, most of them are tenured, and put them through a series of training exercises to help them learn how to be better communicators to the broader world, if you will. And it's been tremendously successful. When we initially started it, we weren't sure that anybody would even apply because this has not been part of the academic culture. People have not wanted to be public. When they were, they've often gotten seriously criticized. It's not built into the value systems of academia, where the real currency is grants, publications, teaching. But despite those cultural impediments, we've had applications from the most outstanding ecologists in the country, and it's been very, very competitive to get into. The program has now trained three groups of 20 environmental scientists, and they are each very, very active and very skilled, very visible now in providing congressional testimony, in being able to explain information to the media, to work with corporate leaders or with non-governmental organizations. So I think it's a really great model program. What I keep hearing from graduate students around the country is their interest in having something similar for them.
In different fields as well, I guess.
And in different fields. I think it's needed in all fields. Because it was begun under the auspices of the Ecological Society of America, we focused very much on environmental sciences. It's actually a pretty diverse group. There are social scientists and engineers and natural scientists in the group of fellows.
In the past, the media gets trained a little bit in how to deal with science to whatever degree they do. There's the public understanding of science, but it's never been the outreach from the scientific world into those other areas.
Right. One of the basic ideas of the program is the importance of both knowing yourself and who you are and what you're good at, but also knowing your audience. So know thyself, know thy audience. And each of those different audiences has a different culture, a different set of values, a different pace. And it's important, I think, for scientists to know that culture and that pace and those values so that there can be better communication. And if you know what policymakers tend to look for, know what the rate of decision making is, know what's going to be useful, then you can do a better job of helping share information with them.
It seems as though back in the 70s, I guess not long after the Stratton Commission came out with their report, there was a flurry of popular culture references or movies about environmental disasters. It was all of a sudden there were all these films, and that seems to have dried up by now, but it's so much worse now, the problem, than it was then. I'm surprised that there aren't more of, there was one film in particular about animals that grew mutated because of spillage from industry. The science isn't always good, but it's sort of an awareness that something's going on.
I think a lot of people got really turned off by doom and gloom, and when there isn't any obvious way for you as an individual to do something about it, and there are a lot of more urgent things going on in your life, that's what you're going to focus on. And I know that quite a few people making TV programs or movies realized that there wasn't a very good audience for doom and gloom kinds of documentaries. I think there was less of a desire to be making them, even though they may have appreciated what the problem was. But if you are making a film for PBS or National Geographic, you want to know that there's going to be an audience that wants to see it. And if the ratings from earlier ones are really bad, then you are not going to be likely to do that. So I think that it's vitally important that information about the environment is not just problem, 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 but is coupled with a balanced view of what alternatives are there, what might be done both by individuals as well as by, you know, countries or the international community, and some sense of both the urgency and the hope. And I think coupling those is critically important, although not easily done.
When you go to give talks and speak to governmental officials and all, can you transmit your own feelings, like say about the coral reef, and you know, maybe show pictures even and say, this is what happens, this is how beautiful it was when I first went, and this is 10 years later, 12 years later. Do you think people would connect to that viscerally if they see that?
I think they do connect to it, and I think that it is certainly useful for scientists to be individuals, be people, talk about how they feel about things, but at the same time, be clear when they're focusing on the scientific information as opposed to their personal views about something. And that's a very challenging dual role for a lot of scientists, to be able to distinguish and clearly separate what the science says from what they might personally believe is the right solution, for example. But being a person and talking about feelings and telling stories, I think, is a very important thing that enables anyone to communicate with other human beings.
And are you continuing research now?
Yes, we have a very active, very exciting program. It's a relatively new program that's called PISCO, which stands for the Partnership for Interdisciplinary Studies of Coastal Oceans. And it's a collaboration between 13 principal investigators at four different universities along the West Coast. The idea was to pool our efforts so that we could together study a very, very large marine ecosystem that's off the West Coast. It's called the California Current Large Marine Ecosystem. It is big enough that no single investigator or studies just at one place like Oregon could get a complete picture of how the whole system works. For us to be doing a better job of managing fishery activity or coastal development or pollution or the wide range of things that are affecting coastal ecosystems, having an understanding of how those systems work, what the dynamics of a large marine ecosystem are, is critically important. And it's not been until recently that we've had the technical capabilities of doing some of that studying at that scale. Now that we have the technical capabilities, there have still been cultural impediments to scientists teaming up and agreeing to do the same kind of measurements the same way all along a system, so that together you have an understanding of what the whole system is doing. There have also been very serious funding impediments. because this kind of big science is not cheap. And traditional funding entities like National Science Foundation, for example, there hasn't been a good match between what they were interested in funding and a kind of long-term, large-scale, interdisciplinary program like PSCO is. We were fortunate in finding a series of principal investigators that all had the same vision of what we wanted to do. And the Packard Foundation was very interested in promoting new models for science, marine studies, and supporting just different ways of doing science in a way that would succeed. And so there was a convergence of all of these different things, which was just a tremendously exciting opportunity. We're now in year 6 of PSCO, and it has been tremendously exciting and productive. We're now really actually getting an understanding of how this large marine ecosystem works by pooling together oceanographers, ecologists, molecular biologists, physiologists, larval biologists, all drawing on the techniques from our different disciplines and applying them to a common set of problems, all of which are designed to understand how this system works. So it's been tremendously exciting, and it's just opening up all sorts of new discoveries. We had 2 papers accepted for publication last week, one in Nature, one in Ecological Monographs, and there have just been, you know, all sorts of new discoveries coming from this system. So it's very exciting.
It is exciting. It's a whole new, like you say, a big science, but hopefully the difficulties you're having now will ease up and also make it easier for other groups to go out and do projects, more collaboration. And
PSCO is very much focused on research, but that's one of the 3 major legs of the program. The other 2 are interdisciplinary training of graduate students and postdocs, and the 3rd is policy and outreach. So the training program, we believe that this concept of putting together all these different kinds of scientific approaches is not only valuable in and of itself, but it's going to have a more long-lasting influence if graduate students and postdocs can really be exposed to the interfaces between these different disciplines. So we have courses that we offer that are interdisciplinary science courses that draw on these amazing scientists that are part of the program. And that's been very exciting. There just aren't opportunities like that for most students. So it's been very, very cool. And the outreach part of the program is completely consistent with the kinds of things we've been talking about, where we don't just make new discoveries and then publish them in scientific literature, but we have a series of publications and videos and opportunities for scientists to talk to citizens, to policymakers, to coastal communities, to whomever is interested, and share the new insights, the new information directly in a way that relates to the decisions that they're making.
Sounds great. So
it's wonderful, and it's just so much fun. We've been very fortunate to have been able to put those pieces together, and then that has attracted other really good scientists, just super outstanding graduate students and postdocs, so it's very exciting.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.